It is a double-edged sword being up here from the point of view that says it is always a blessing to have a weight placed upon you to dig into the Word and to go deeper and to study and analyze. And the downside of that, though, is in doing so, it often brings to light a lot of things that we conveniently like to avoid because they're uncomfortable. So there's I think the admonition about careful to you teachers, because what you bring to people you better put on yourself. So a little town of Bethlehem is the title of today's sermon, and I had to laugh because when I initially looked it up and started reading it, I had a flashback to being a little kid, and like Wes had said, the idea of this is a Christmas thing, and I can still remember to this day, the Peanuts Christmas version quotes this. Charles Schulz, whether it was God inspired or he's Messianic Jew or whatever, but he put this inside one of the most popular Christmas cartoons ever. And I had heard it, and I thought, oh, that's kind of neat, not knowing where it was coming from or just a little kid. And then when I looked it up, it was like I stepped back in time and thought, oh, I remember all the quaint little thoughts I had about Bethlehem and this little, you know, place and where Jesus was born. And often we settle with an idea we have satisfied without actually digging deeper into it. And so this gave me an opportunity to dig into a little bit of Bethlehem, not being the cute little place that Charlie Brown and Snoopy were talking about, but what is the real deal? So Micah 5:2, it says, "But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of you shall come forth to me the one to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth are from of old and from everlasting." Now Micah, again, being a minor prophet, what's the context of when he wrote this? He lived from about 740 to 687 BC in Judah. He was running in the same time frame as Isaiah. And that's the part, you know, interesting, that when the books are separated in the Bible, and if you're not paying attention, you'll think that they have no connection. These guys were living at the same time, and they were operating amongst the same people. Now, Micah tended to be seen as somebody who comes from a humbler social class than Isaiah did, from a little town called Moresheth, which was about 25 kilometers from Jerusalem. And that he was alive, similar to Isaiah, during multiple kings, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah. Not a great time for Jerusalem. And high moral decay. Said that there was, at that time, there was social stratifying, meaning previous to that, there was, for the most part, an agricultural society. And it was during this time that society started to separate itself from the haves and the have-nots, and that the land barons started to emerge, and then you had the outcrop of the peasant people and the landowners, so the rich and the poor. And so there was cruelty, and big cities started to grow at this time. And so if you were poor, you would end up, you know, working as a laborer for a land baron or in the city. A lot of corruption, a lot of cruelty. And it also brought about a lot of trade with other pagan nations. So the infiltration and the influence of other gods, cults, false practices. And so Micah was there to call out to Judah and Samaria and Jerusalem, giving them a warning that the track that they were on was headed for destruction, and that there would be a price to pay, and how God was going to step in and judge them. But he ends with a positive, saying, and here's where Micah comes in, but there's that key word for God, I have a plan for this, and I will offer redemption in this. So this is not just a destruction package. There's a calling you out, here's the consequences, and here will be the plan of restoration. So considering that in six chapters of Micah, it's pretty packed. And back to Bethlehem a little bit, there's actually two Bethlehems. And so there was Bethlehem Ephrath or Ephrathah, kind of goes back and forth. This one in particular was about 5 miles from Jerusalem. And the other one was in Zebulun. And so the Bethlehem Ephrath defined that. In other places it's called Judah, but it's that little village. Bethlehem is translated house of bread. And Ephrath actually is converted to mean fruitfulness. So when the two are put together, it's fruitful house of bread. Quite a fitting picture of once you peel back the layers, the descriptions of Christ, how he designated himself. I'm the bread of life. And I just happen to be born in the village that's called the fruitful house of bread. You know, funny how once you look at all these little, every little piece is accounted for. And conversely, I had never considered, you can read the Bible, but unless you're paying attention to fine details, a lot of stuff just goes by. And recognizing that Bethlehem didn't just appear on the scene, you know, in either Micah or in Luke. Bethlehem's actually spoken of all through the Old Testament. And again, I've read these many times, not paying attention to these little things in Genesis 35. 35:16. It says, talking about Jacob and his wife Rachel and the clan that were with them. Then they journeyed from Bethel, and when there was but a little distance to go to Ephrath, Rachel labored in childbirth, and she had hard labor. Now it came to pass, when she was in hard labor, that the midwife said to her, "Do not fear, you will have this son also." And so it was, as her soul was departing, for she died, that she called his name Ben-Oni. But his father called him Benjamin. Ben-Oni is translated son of sorrow, because she was dying as she was giving birth. And Jacob changed it to Benjamin, which means son of my right hand or high favor. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. So there's an interesting picture of another woman heading to Bethlehem giving birth. And how what was initially, and she considered it as a sorrowful time, God actually flipped and said, no, actually this is a blessing. And Benjamin will be a part of the picture here. And then if you flip over to Ruth, you know, it's funny, we studied Ruth last week. And in Ruth, we read how, now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the names of his wife was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. So now we have the story of Ruth rooted in Bethlehem. And conversely, chapter 2, there was a relative of Naomi's husband, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz. And thus we know the story of Boaz being the kinsman redeemer. Amazingly that happened in Bethlehem too. So, and then if you flip over to Ruth 4:18, now this is the genealogy of Perez. Perez begot Hezron. Hezron begot Ram, and Ram begot Amminadab. Amminadab begot Nahshon, and Nahshon begot Salmon. Salmon begot Boaz, and Boaz begot Obed. So there's Boaz with Ruth. Obed begot Jesse, and Jesse begot David. So again, an interesting link going through generations of generations that end up with Bethlehem being the seat and the connection point of so much of God's story. 1 Samuel 17, verse 12. Now David was the son of that Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, and who had 8 sons, and the man was old, advanced in years in the days of Saul. So, again, back to the confirmation of David being rooted in Bethlehem. He was born there, his brothers were likely born there, his father was born there, and you can trace the lineage all the way up. Now, Bethlehem was not a big place, nor was it, you know, outside of the key players that have played there, a very important town. It was a small village, maybe some hundreds of people, and it wasn't considered important. In fact, Judah, which was the district of the area, didn't even consider it as part of or being important enough that it'd be listed as part of its assets. So I don't know if we wanted to make a translation, you know, in this area, you know, would a little hamlet outside of the Sioux be considered something that would say, this is part of our identity and this is what makes us important, and we're connected to, you know, a little village down the road. But up to that point, it was still recognized, as we roll into the New Testament, it was recognized as the birthplace of David, and it was recognized as going to be the birthplace of the Messiah. God picks unlikely people, clearly, and unlikely places to craft his plans. How opposite it is of how people would consider what we consider important. We tend to be drawn towards places, lots of people, lots of money, prestige, honor, fanfare, you know, bright lights, big city mentality. If we're going to lay out a marquee for the world to know, we're going to pick all those things which tend to, in our mind, be that which would highlight the importance. Yet God is consistent in his selection process. The Bible is filled with examples of God using the unorthodox, the unexpected, the foolish, the unknowns to showcase his grand separation between our wisdom and his. You know, I'm going to touch on a couple of things that would just kind of be quite ironic in how we would do it. How am I going to populate the world? I'll pick an old man and a woman that's past their childbirthing years, and I'm going to say, that's where that's going to come from. Would I put that out there, or would anybody believe that? A reluctant and potential stutterer to stand up to the world's strongest man at the time, or the world's most powerful man, Pharaoh, and then to lead a nation. Story of Moses. A teenage shepherd boy with a slingshot to lead an army against a giant. 7 dips in a dirty river to cure leprosy. Speaking in a soft whisper when he has the volume of the universe to make his point, like he did with Elijah. Tumbling massive walls with a trumpet and shouting instead of bringing in explosives and a demolition team. Again, God always uses things that only point to his power and his wisdom and his omnipotence. He doesn't bother with using the tools that we would, because then we could insert ourselves as part of the rewards and the accolades, and God gets kind of pushed to the side and we get to wave our banner and say that we had something to do with it. God's plan will always involve that wisdom and the view from the ages, which will not seem the most practical or timely or energy conserving from our vantage point. In a high efficiency world that we live in, we look for what's the quickest, easiest, cheapest way to get the job done. From A to B, straight line. It's promoted, it's taught, it seems to be common sense. Thankfully, God did not ask our input for how to do what his eternal plan would require. What a very predictable formula that we would concoct. If God had even connected with Adam and said, "Okay, Adam, how should we figure this out? How are we going to turn this whole mess that you've created? How do you want to turn it and come out with a positive ending?" And Adam probably would have been not so different than us in terms of what he would have been drawn towards. Let's take a look at how the world would put together a marquee like that. We would just have to take a look at Hollywood, and I use that as a global setting being representing the world. We won't look at that too long. To see what the human imagination comes up with when it thinks of plans to save the world. It would take the biggest, the strongest, the best looking hunk of a guy that everyone wants to be like or adores, writes a script where he has all of the upper hand in all the situations, uses strength, guns, power, violence, charisma to outsmart, outwit, outpower, and ultimately humiliate and probably kill all the bad guys, all to the adulation and the outpouring of affection from all. You can watch any movie, book, or other human creation, and the formula of this will be very close. You know, essentially, you know, James Bond with wings. You know, that's the guy who has it all together, who has all the answers, and just rises above every situation, doesn't get dirty, doesn't sweat it, just literally has outthought and outsmarted and has all these particular skills and abilities that has him working on a different plane, and we would all hold him up highly. Even Christians cannot resist the flesh and the sin nature by applying these, I'll call them biases, to our depiction of how God works and chooses. And I started paying attention to this. Every Samson depiction, and I have purposely gone out and watched a bunch of characterizations of, you know, Old Testament stories. And every Samson movie that I've ever seen, they got pretty much the equivalent Arnold Schwarzenegger playing the role of Samson. And because that fits in our brain, that guy with all those muscles must be very strong. So clearly that's what God would use if he's going to represent somebody who's very strong. And thus, when you see him, you think, well, a guy like that should be able to pick up, you know, the gates of the village and put it on his shoulders. It does not make you think, wow, that must be God. You just say, that guy is huge. And so he has his own power, his own strength. God does not get the glory when the Incredible Hulk picks up and does things that only he could do. It does if somebody like, you know, 120-pound little skinny guy who's never been in the gym in his life walks up and picks up something. Then you say, well, clearly that's not him doing that work. Then the eyes go to God. And even selections for actors who play Christ. And I don't know, you know, there's a tricky part here. In all the depictions that I've ever seen, they tend to have him as a tall, well-built, healthy, attractive man, long hair, nice soft eyes, beautiful smile. And how does this compare to God's picture, though, of what Christ was? If you turn to Isaiah 53, well, you don't have to turn, but it says specifically, God's Christ has no form or comeliness, and when we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. And so I would imagine that he would be, from a visual sense, somebody that we wouldn't even pay attention to. He did not have a great physical demeanor. He did not have physical attributes that would draw people to him. People wouldn't look to him and say, oh, you're the guy that's going to save the world because look at you. You're the total package. In fact, he would be the exact opposite. You know, he would not be somebody that people would be drawn to so that God would get the glory in how and what he did. And that there would be no confusion as to who actually Christ was, because it wouldn't be something that our flesh would be drawn towards. It would have to be a spiritual drawing. How incredible the vastness between how we conceptualize beauty and how God does. The contrast between our ways and God's ways are seen abundantly in how he chose how to save the world. Let's start with a long lead-in, such that people will be told rescue is on the way. And I'm going back to Genesis 3 here. But they will have to wait, as opposed to instant gratification, like we all are drawn towards. I want it all, and I want it now. We've all probably raised children or are familiar with children that says that spirit that says, I don't want to wait for anything. Give it to me now, and I want the best. To the tune of about 4,000 years, give or take, before the promise of the seed is fulfilled. God sets his own timeline, his own characters, and it rarely makes sense when you see it from your own personal experience or how you would do it, thankfully. And rarely will it ever satisfy our hyper-scheduling, where we can put it on the calendar or we can put it on our day planner and say, here's the day, God, that I need this done, or that you need to do something, or I have it all figured out when you should insert yourself and turn this situation around. You know, God says, I'll give you the ending right away from the start. No hidden agendas, no cameo appearances. I'll lay it out pretty clearly to everyone. To the woman, I'll increase the sorrow and conception. In pain you shall bring forth children, etc. To the man, cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. For dust you are, and dust you shall return. Here's the but again. To the serpent, he shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. So God has again laid out the punishments, but he is finishing with, there is a promise of redemption. But it'll be my time and my way of doing it. And you can probably project yourself into Adam and Eve saying, you know, even with the way that, you know, then they had Cain and they had Abel, and, you know, and then Abel was gone and they had a new son, Seth, saying, well, surely this must be it. God, you're not going to wait like too long before you bring the promised seed here. And people die off and everything continues to get worse. And there's probably a sense of giving up that says, you know, maybe God, maybe this is bigger than God can manage. And each of them would come up with their own plan on how to help God, or take the bull by the horns and try and manage it better than God could. And how he rolls out his narrative is never with the expected players, the props, locations, or the powers. Bethlehem, a little village with not a lot to offer, was the backdrop of this whole narrative. As we see from Rachel in labor, going to Bethlehem and dying, with Benjamin, the son of sorrow, changed to the son of the right hand, we see a pattern emerging. The town was also the location for another picture of salvation, Boaz. David, the apple of God's eye, was born there, and his whole lineage. What about that complication of Bethlehem having to be the birthplace of the Messiah? You would think that doesn't sound like a big deal. Why not just pick two people that actually live there and make them the ones that are going to bring, you know, the Christ child in? Why would you have to pick people that live so far away? And it gets complicated. God's plan and the choice of Mary does not get compromised due to the fact that long traveling while in labor is not the first choice for expectant mothers. If you're a mother, would you say, yeah, on my labor day, I'd like to get on a donkey and travel through a desert and, you know, and with unexpected, no plans, no provisions? I'm guessing not. God said, but that's the human way of doing things. I have my own way of doing it. So a royal edict is issued to make sure that they are in Bethlehem for the birth. A lowly village with no accommodations, no medical care. Why not Jerusalem, the holy city? Is it not more fitting for a king? My kids are far from royalty, and yet when they were born, they probably had some of the finest medical care available in the world. And we're just commoners. When I consider the hospitals and the doctors and the nurses and all the technology and all the stuff, ICU nurses and all the probably millions of dollars that went into to my children getting born, and we're just common folk. How about Prince Harry and Prince William? Those are some royalty that have had attention from their birth. My guess is that the finest of the finest people in England would have had to petition just to pick up the dirty diapers. Okay? Like, you want to talk about a disconnect. And yet the king and creator of the universe not only chose, but he accepted the lowly state and the humble entrance. It certainly speaks to our desire or our expectations of entitlement regarding things that our Savior not only did not demand, but he actually rejected. I want to come in a way that says nobody can see themselves as being in a harder place than I am. Okay, I will not have, I will come in as lowly as you can come. No nurses, no running water, no bed, animals as my nurses, and not even with the place that people want me there. No room at the inn. We have a little barn back there that you can go do your thing in. So Bethlehem was the prophesied location in the birthplace of David. And that comes from one of them in Isaiah 9:6, where it says, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. And of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice. From that time forward, even forever, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this." So we start in Micah, where Christ is described as, or the child is described as, whose goings forth are from of old, from everlasting, to the point where Isaiah says the same. And then if we turn into Luke, it identifies Christ the same way. He was in the beginning with God. From Micah, John 1:2, he was in the beginning with God. Revelation, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, who is and who was and who is to come, the Almighty. Now let's go back to the Bethlehem, or at least the initial birth story. When the wise men showed up before Herod, said, "Show us where the Messiah is." Herod, and it says all of Jerusalem was stirred up by this. He questioned the chief priests as to where the Christ was to be born. And they stated, if you read Matthew 2:6, it says, if you could put your finger at Micah 5:2, and then put your finger at Matthew 2:6, it says, "But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not the least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." If you look at those closely, they are not an exact copy. The chief priests did not quote Micah fully. Now, there's some debate as to whether what the motives were, whether that was unintentional, whether there was some editorializing by Matthew. But I think that that it has to do more with the fact that they did not quote the part where it said, whose goings forth are from of old, from everlasting. And essentially what they were doing is they were leaving out the part that said that this is God. They were essentially, they were giving a picture, don't forget who their audience was, to Herod, that said, essentially, the picture that they have was that this ruler that's coming, Herod, he will be a ruler in Israel, okay? Which means you're going to be out. It's almost like, who's the boss? We have the boss coming, okay? And again, with that, with the idea that they're always looking for a military leader, somebody that's going to overthrow the Romans, and he's going to come. David was a great warrior. We expect the Christ, when he comes, he will be a great warrior, and so he will be our Messiah. Whether it's a misunderstanding, whether it's they were connecting the Messiah with the title and accolades given to David. They confirmed David's birthplace as the birthplace of the Messiah, and they were assuming his military might. Now we'll see who's boss kind of attitude to Herod. And whether they did not believe that at the time, or the fact that they said, these wise men coming here asking us about the Messiah, we're the experts, okay? Clearly, if they had believed that the Christ had come, they would have went with the wise men. They would have went to Bethlehem themselves. If somebody shows up at your door and says, hey, I heard something about your kids, would you say, oh, really? I never heard that. And would you not travel with them? Hey, I heard your child was in an accident. They're in the hospital. Really? I would jump in my car and I would run to the hospital. If somebody came to Jerusalem and said, I hear the Messiah is here. Really? He's supposed to show up in Bethlehem. Oh, okay. And let it go. And Herod cooked that plot, but it does not record that the chief priests followed them up. Everybody had been warned. It said Jerusalem was all abuzz that these wise men rolled into town looking for the Messiah, but they were the only ones that went to Bethlehem, by the sounds of it, to look for it. And if you consider that there was between, you know, this is 2 years and less from his birth, the wise men would have been talking about this too. Or sorry, not the wise men, the shepherds would have been all been sharing this. It would not have been a secret, but yet nobody moved. It took the wise men to come to stir Herod. Still, the chief priests did not believe it. You know, it can be easily argued that the rejection of Christ started at his birth. Forget about when he ushered, when his ministry rolled out. Even his birth, they rejected him as the Messiah because they knew it was coming, they knew where it was coming, and when it was announced, nobody went. So it looks so clear coming from our perspective, looking in the rearview mirror of Scripture, how exacting and perfectly coordinated all pieces of the puzzle fit together. He was to be born in Bethlehem. I will call him out of Egypt. He should be called a Nazarene. All titles which were fulfilled, as well as so many other prophecies that we've been studying. Yet so many people missed it. And they were looking right at it. It was actually directly calling out to them, demanding attention. The life of Christ was spent among the people whose sole purpose in life was to search out and to live a life and to point others to him, to God. And there he was. And when he came to them and he said, here I am. Consider that day in the temple where he read the Isaiah. Follow me. They essentially said, be quiet, get out of the way. We're looking for God. And you definitely are not him. In fact, you're probably from the devil. Get out of the way. And he continued to come to them and repeat the message and even show proofs to validate his claims. And the more he showed them the truth, the more they rejected him. Why is that? Because they had in their head what God would look like, what he would talk like, what he would act like, what he would smell like. You know, if you go back to Jesus was breaking the mold in their head that said what God would be like. You're healing on the Sabbath. You're eating on the Sabbath. You're hanging out with unscrupulous, sinful people. You're doing all sorts of things that don't fit our picture. So that clearly disqualifies you from being that person. The saddest reality is that they chased after a God that they had invented. And that God would just happen to be him, which would validate and approve of them and their beliefs and their actions. So again, back to that point that said, they had a very rigid sense of who God was. And Christ came and he blew that to smithereens. And they would not have any of it. Because for God to be God would mean that they would be called to change. They would be called to repent. They would be called to give up their practices. They'd be called to give up their identity. They'd be called to give up everything that their life had been built upon. Their hard-heartedness, their hypocrisy, their insistence on laws and sacrifices and offerings, yet without compassion or love. So they had all the behaviors down, but they didn't have the right heart, because their heart was defined by, I have created a world. I've created a God that says everything I do is okay. And so I give myself thumbs up. I'm okay. I judge myself according to a God that I have made in my head. Christ, in Luke 11 and 12 and 13, if you read them, it's almost punch for punch, between Christ and the chief priests, gives an overall commentary to their whole existence and God's judgment of it. And he pointed out their hypocrisy. They're living a life where every breath, every step, every thought is focused on God, but a God that they have created. The result, Luke 13:17 says, and when he had said all these things, where he actually called out all of the heart and the hypocrisy of the chief priests, and when he had said all these things, all his adversaries were put to shame. God had judged. He had clearly set the standard for, if you actually want to be somebody who will be a follower of God, this is what it will look like. And they rejected it because that meant that they would have to give up so much of what they had built their lives on. They had built their own God. There was idolatry. You know, if idolatry is I make false gods, that was the prime example. It is easy to point the fingers at the Pharisees, though. How could they not see or understand? God was in front of their face. The same way that we, too probably, have a picture of God which we've created that blocks us from seeing his true self. Following rules, missing the relationship. Christ specifically brought out how their relationship with God was seen and how they treat each other. James, again, Jesus' half-brother, grew up in the same house with him. Jesus would have been his big brother. He did not see the truth until after the resurrection. But he states, be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. And that is the key part here, that it's not the action and the words so much as it is you have told yourself things that agree with how you roll. And when they are lies, you now have created a barrier between yourself and God. So as we consider our walk in this world and with the Lord, let us not ensnare ourselves by creating a God that agrees, this is me speaking, with my beliefs and my behaviors, which slowly but surely, if you're not paying close attention, will have drifted from the authentic spirit revealed in the essence of Christ and his plan to that which makes me feel comfortable in my world. It's a slow but steady progression. We are wired. We have nervous systems that say we want to avoid uncomfortable stuff. Okay? If there's an element there and it's hot, my nervous system is wired to pull my hand away so I don't get burned. Okay? And at an emotional, psychological, spiritual level, it works the opposite. Well, we also don't want to feel uncomfortable, but in those situations, unless we actually, and we trust that God is that element not to burn us, but to purify us, we will pull away from anything that makes us uncomfortable. How I should live my life, what I do with my finances, my ministry with my neighbors, you name it. Anything that makes me feel uncomfortable, there is an automatic reaction to pull away, and then our mind will say, that is okay, or this is the right way to do it. And pretty soon, my picture of God lines up perfectly with how I'm living my life. And short of Christ, who lived a perfect life, I would say that is a great trap and a great insulating factor from actually feeling and knowing and growing in who God is and personally in our sanctification. If you are believing that you are operating in a way that does not need refinement, then you have created a God that just happens to give approval to your sin. Let us not live our lives being busy and talking about God, yet missing having a true relationship with him and living out of our comfort zone because we have adopted his truth and not our comfort. So while the Pharisees and chief priests and all those guys typically get hammered for them rejecting of Christ, the danger just in taking that stance says we would never do that. And there's another danger that says we because we have the Spirit of God living in us, it does not mean that we do not operate in error in areas and that we are to be constantly asking God, bring my hand to the fire. Refine me so that I do not create a picture of you that allows me to live where I'm at. Because I would guess, just based upon my own experience, that there's lots of areas for each of us to grow. And the fact that if we're not aimed at that, it is because we have somehow found a sweet spot in our life that said, I can putt along. God's okay with me being right here. Yes, I know there's some things that, you know, I should probably improve on. No different than I should probably go exercise. You know what, I'll do it another day or whatever. Those parts that are built into us that give us a thumbs up instead of saying, what am I called to be? What is the standard God has set? And if I haven't hit it, have I just settled? And have I just set myself up believing that God is still okay with that? And while he does eternal forgiveness, I believe that we are the ones that deprive ourselves both of the relationship with him and the impact on the world. And when I see the amount and how much of the world is encroaching on Christianity and each person with very little pushback, and there's general a compliance or at least a silence to roll, again, I convict myself and I ask myself, have I lived according to what I know to be true? And if not, why not? You know, am I witnessing to my neighbors? Am I, you know, doing things that I know I used to, that used to be a passion of mine, and I actually did bit of a checklist, and I said, when's the last time I have actually, you know, done something in the name of God, risking rejection, risking humiliation, risking finances, you know, all those things? Well, there's a lot on, it's almost easier to operate and to live when you have very little, because then you have very little to lose, so you don't hold on to it. And as, you know, the health, wealth, and prosperity message says, oh, God has blessed me, and look at, you know, look at my cattle and look at my barns, and God has filled them. Now it's like, wow, I probably got those at some level because I have absorbed some of the systems of the world, because if I had been bold, I would have told that person, I don't want this. Let me tell you about Christ. Well, so there is a sacrifice. And if we're not sacrificing and we're not paying somewhere along the line, then we have bought into the economy. And that economy is not which A, refines you, grows you, or changes the world. So I would just have you consider those as, again, as I was challenged. I would imagine that each of us has those areas in life that we do not make God in an image of comfort for ourselves, but that we would say, God, show me where I have taken on the wrong picture of who you are and help me to grow in it. So, Father, we just thank you for the blessing of your word. I pray, Lord, that you would speak to each of our hearts in those areas where, Lord, that we can connect with you more fully, more authentically, that we can be the light and we can express love as we receive it from you, that we might share it with others, and that we would not fear the rejection of this world or even the uncomfortableness that comes with getting to know you in a more perfect and truthful way. Help us to live, Lord, as you would have us. In Jesus' name.